discussion a few weeks ago by Dr. Frank Press concerning the role of the National Academy of Sciences, and now our discussion today on the National Science Foundation, we reach a certain high point in our examination of science from the standpoint of knowledge and continuity in the field. Dr. Eric Block has been the director of the National Science Foundation since 1984. He is a distinguished scientist and engineer. He was born in Salzburg, Germany, and came to the United States in 1948, became a citizen in 1952. He was educated at the Federal Polytechnic Institute in Zurich and at the University of Buffalo. He has honorary degrees from such distinguished institutions as the University of Rochester, University of Buffalo, University of Massachusetts, and others. He worked and served with the IBM Corporation from 1952 to 1984, first as vice president and general manager, and then as vice president of technical personnel development. A member of the Commission on Computers in Automated Manufacture, and has been an author and a recipient of the U.S. Medal of Technology. For all these reasons, and also because he has demonstrated as an energetic leader of the National Science Foundation that he's an excellent communicator, why we are especially pleased that he could be with us today.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Thompson. I didn't know that Frank Press was here a few weeks ago, otherwise I would have told you a different story that I'm telling you now. The reason for it is very simple. I really didn't want to talk about the National Science Foundation today at all, but Frank Press and I, not physically, but administratively and institutionally, we're always getting mixed up. I go up on the hill and somebody, famous senator, says, "I just was in your building the other day. That Einstein statue is really beautiful." And you know quite well, he was somewhere else. So the problem is, you know, to keep these two organizations apart, but I don't think I have to tell you what the difference is. You know it yourself. But I'll get back to that in a few minutes. Marta Zahelski is one of my colleagues here. She was responsible to introducing and injecting into this talk today some of the controversial issues. So if you don't like them, there is a problem. And I also want, you can complain to her. And I also want to introduce Bill Wolf, who is an assistant director at the National Science Foundation for computer science and computer engineering. You also hold a position here at this university, something like that. Okay, very good. So that explains his presence. But I'm very glad to be here and to talk a little bit about the science policy process, and I know this is a major topic, or has been a major topic here, and coincidentally, I'm kind of interested also in that topic. So let me start from a little bit of a personal perspective. It's a good time to look at science policy, and especially for me, this is my sixth and last year of my appointment as director of the National Science Foundation. And there's a natural inclination after that length of time to reflect a little bit on one's experience, good and bad. More to the point, however, and more on a more objective kind of a basis, there are good reasons to be concerned with our science policy. We are living in a time of extraordinary change. The dramatic transformation of Eastern European politics and economics is certainly one such signal, and I don't think there's anybody who can start a talk without mentioning that for good and valid reasons. But there's more to it than that. It's a shift from a national economy to an integrated world economy. Certainly is one that affects us all, and that needs to affect our science policy. I don't know if it has, but it needs to affect it. Let me give you a couple examples with regard, or an example with regard to the U.S. merchandise trade. In 1970, it amounted to about 8% of GNP. By 1985, it about doubled to over 13% of a total that rose nearly fivefold over the same period of time. So we are live in a different kind of a world. The global economic arena has become fiercely and broadly competitive for all nations, and we see that every day. But even more important than any of these events, I believe, is the emergence of information and knowledge technology as the engines of economic and political change. And I think we really underestimate that influence. Knowledge has become the critical resource, as important as natural resources were or skilled labor was in the past, in earlier times. The foundation of new industries such as computers and biotechnology, semiconductors, and any of the new designed materials that are not found in nature pay, essentially make that particular point. But more than that, I think knowledge and information sciences have revolutionized the workplace, certainly, have revolutionized education, you know, in a broad way, and have even revolutionized the way we are doing research today. High-performance computers are at the basis of much of our work in research at all levels. But more important than that, networking is one of the prerequisites today of reaching out to colleagues, not just across the country, but across the world. I think that's a different kind of a world that we are entering than the ones that we have been in. Further and most important, the new information and knowledge technologies have been reshaping the global political and economic relations. U.S. technological and economic leadership after World War II was really based on these new industries that I've been talking about. The European economic integration, Europe 1992. I don't know how much that one is driven by this emergence of the knowledge economy and the knowledge technologies, but I would bet a great deal, because you're seeing the focus that Europe 1992 is taking on these days. It's essentially trying to pull together the various countries to do jointly what each individual country has been unable to do over the last 30 years and has been trying to do, getting a foothold in some of the newer sciences. The whole Pacific power bloc, with Japan as its center, is based essentially on this new knowledge revolution that I've been talking about. In this knowledge economy, investing in science and engineering research and having a well-educated technical workforce is becoming of high national priorities for all nations. Let me just give you again the example of Europe 1992. It'll be a formidable competitor for the U.S., not only in trade, but in research as well. In the 1980s, early 80s, the total U.S. spending for civilian R&D exceeded that of the EC nations by 40%. By 1988, our lead declined to 10%. And by 1992, parity between Europe and U.S. is highly likely. And I think that is a situation that we have not faced in the past. While we are talking belatedly, by the way, very glibly about competition in trade, we really need to talk about competition in research also, and see where that leads us. Today, suspending by the European community on a community basis is less than 4% of the R&D spending of all its member nations. But over time, the EEC will aggregate more power to itself, and the individual country's spending and programs as a consequence will decline. And I think this is something which we are only now waking up to see what it means to ourselves and how we need to position ourselves vis-a-vis Europe. In the past, we have positioned ourselves vis-a-vis certain countries in Europe. And I think there's a new development coming that we better realize and rationalize with our own behavior and our own strategy, if we have one. I think the growing strengths of our competitors in science and technology has some contradictory consequences. On the positive side, the potential for major contribution to the general pool of knowledge obviously is exactly what we all desire, because research is it can be used by everybody. Turn on the front. So that's on the positive side. In fact, if we get this straight, I'll amuse you with some colored slides, by the way, but you don't really have to look at them. They're not that important, but I think you can do a little bit better. There you go. That's good. Thank you. But what you see here, essentially over a period of 20 years, how various countries have caught up with us in at least percent of GNP spending on research development. And I call that a positive development. The pool of knowledge is being increased by that. The ability to address global problems is certainly on a positive of it. And sharing the cost of expensive facilities, of which we are not taking full advantage of, by the way, as a country, but certainly which the European countries among themselves are doing. Just think of CERN as an example. I think that is one of the big developments that in the future will be helpful to all nations that engage in, especially in basic research, in the sciences as well as in engineering. On the other hand, on the negative side, science and technology, being increasingly an economic good, stimulate determination of individual countries to protect the benefits of their R&D investment. And as a consequence, you see such things as in this country, congressional concern with what's called the big American giveaway, namely letting foreign countries and foreign companies give access to our university and university research. Obviously, it's a simplistic view of saying we have to deny them access, because if we deny access, they'll do the same thing. The walls will go up and nobody will be the winner. In fact, we will be the loser. But nevertheless, be that as it may, there are new issues that we are facing, like standards, intellectual property rights, future exchanges of scientists and engineers, which will be much more, let me say, different, maybe not more difficult, but certainly different than they have been in the past. So these are the two sides of this interesting development, namely the increase in science research and the investment therein. Given this competitive environment, the question is, do we have a science policy adequate to meeting the challenge? And this is what I would like to spend the remainder of my remarks really on addressing this point. What's good about our science policy process today? How could it be better? What kind of problems are we facing? And by the way, I will be very intense on 1 and 3. How we could do it better, I leave up to you to determine. So let's look at some of the strengths and weaknesses of the system in which we operate and then see where we go from here. First, what are our strengths? Well, judging by our achievements in science and technology, we have been doing something right. Over half the Nobel Prizes over the last 40 years in the physical sciences and engineering were awarded to U.S. Researchers. The world leadership in technology and innovation for the last 30 years was ours. There was a clear superiority in the generation of new knowledge across the full disciplinary spectrum and in the education of highly talented scientists and engineers. And if you don't believe it, just look at the number of foreign students that are coming here to get their education here. What better result can you expect? The basic principles for supporting basic research were laid in place after World War II, and I'm showing you this here. It's kind of an interesting chart. By the way, on the left side you see constant dollars, constant 1988 dollars. On the right hand side you see percent of total. And you see essentially the tremendous increase in the 50s and 60s in terms of academic expenditures for basic research, applied research and development, and then a flattening out of that curve in the 70s and early 80s, and an increase again over the last 5, 6, 7 years. By the way, I'm going to come back to that increase later on and talk some more about it. But really what's very clear about this is the federal government assumes a responsibility, because most of that, in the beginning at least, was federal spending for supporting basic research. The universities obviously played the major role in that. It wasn't so much the government laboratories or the private sector. And today about 70% of all basic research is being done by universities. Not all 70% is being supported by the federal government, but a good share of it is. The third point that was put in place was that the researchers themselves would decide what is worth investigating. I think we have kept pretty much to that system with some changes here and there. It's a combination of research, basic research and education. It's a co-location of basic research and education was one of the big foundations and assumptions that went into that funding that I have been talking about and the building up of the system that I've been talking about. And I think we have to ask ourselves today, where do we go from here? The result is a very broad-based, pluralistic, but also a very complex kind of an enterprise. There are about 3,000 institutions of higher learning in the United States, 10% of which are research universities. Not that the other ones don't do any research, but they do research to a minor extent compared to that 10% I'm talking about. The federal government funds about half of the national R&D, and as I mentioned before, about 70% of the basic research. The other half of the national R&D obviously comes out of the states and out of the private sector. R&D is supported primarily through six agencies: NSF, NASA, NIH, DOD, DOE, and USDA, and I have more to say about that. And basic research is supported primarily by NSF and NIH in different areas, and DOD and DOE to a less significant kind of role. And therein lies the problem, by the way, because that certainly wasn't the case in the 1950s. And I want to come back to that one also. Obviously, we have, besides the universities, there's industry and there's the national laboratories, and I have no intention of belaboring that point. So the policy process pulling this complex and pluralistic and broad-based research enterprise together has been low-keyed, and like the system itself, it is fragmented, has been fragmented, is fragmented, and it's diffused. By the way, probably the system worked well in the past, when at a time when the system was being built up, anything works well when there's a lot of money on the table, and when the system is just starting. There were major increases, as I'm showing you here, and there was no competition from abroad, hardly any competition from abroad. And the question, however, that I think we have to ask ourselves, will that system that we have put in place and that served us well, will it work in the future? And I would suggest to you, without elaborating on it, and I hope you will elaborate on it later on, I don't think it will. But that's a personal opinion. So let me turn, with that comment, let me turn to what are our weaknesses. A lot of talk in recent years has been about the so-called science advisor problem, and that's really a shorthand for lack of focus in science and technology in the total process. Let's ask ourselves, what's the status of science advice in the White House? At times, as with PSAC in the 1950s and 60s, the President's Science Advisory Committee of that time, science advice and the presidential science advisor were held in high regard. At other times, both advice and advisor have been regarded with greater indifference or even hostility. Just look at the Nixon administration and what went on there. So we had some good years and we had some bad years. That's the only way you can make that point. Many people consider the PSAC as the golden age of science advice, and I never know if that is just a historical color or if it was really the case. And it's hard to figure out, especially when you talk to some people that were in the middle of that and that have now become a little bit older. And I don't have to say more than that. What are some of the other weaknesses? The science advisor did not have institutional access to the president. Was certainly one of the weaknesses. Doesn't mean that the science advisor did not have any access to the president, but it was more on a personal basis. If people like Jerry Wiesner were in place, the access was great. When other people were in place, it wasn't. White House Office of Science and Technology Policy did not have authority to set policy or coordinate budgets. OMB was the only organization, when its forerunner, with a policy overview, but it had been driven by budgetary concerns, not substantive ones. Let's turn to the Congress. Equally bad. The executive branch is not the only problem. Congress is the other problem. Science budgets submitted by the federal agencies are considered by 12 different committees today. There are only about 12 committees in the whole House that consider budgets. The budget of the National Science Foundation is grouped with that of HUD and Veterans Administration. And by the way, if you want to find your way through it, be my guest. I'm going to leave this here and somebody can study it. Write a PhD thesis about it. It has no exit, by the way, so if you look for an exit, it's not there. But the point I want to make with this particular chart is really very simple. Regardless where you are, if you're interested in engineering or the physical sciences or in psychology, you have to deal with many, many different organizations in the executive branch as well as in the legislative kind of a branch. No agency is responsible for the overall health of either a discipline or the total, essentially. And the legislative process is a highly fragmented one. Recently, there have been some improvements in the science policy process. Strong support for basic research by two administrations was certainly one of these improvements. The NSF budget doubled from 1983 to 1988, and it's supposed to double again between now and 1993. Time will tell if that will happen, but I think we are on the road. There has been, for the first time a couple of years ago, there have been a congressional approval of a 5-year authorization for NSF. First time that a multi-year authorization for any of the science agencies, certainly for NSF, was put in place. And by the way, while authorizations are meaningless when it comes to spending money, it's highly important, because we have not had, over the last few years, the kind of discussions we had year after year with the authorization committee every year. And that in itself, I think, is helpful. Also, it had its effect on OMB. We didn't have the same discussions on details that we had over the past. It was assumed right from the beginning that we are on a doubling kind of a track, and we were left alone from there. And that's quite helpful. The campaign commitment by President Bush to upgrade the status of science and engineering in the White House, I think, has been put in place with the appointment of Alan Parmley and with his elevation to advisor to the president, essentially, or assistant to the president from advisor. The new President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology Policy, or PCAST, has been put in place. There was the first meeting a few weeks ago. There's another one this week, end of this week. So you see essentially some changes being made, at least in the administrative end of things. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said about Congress. Major science and technology issues like global warming, biotechnology, science and engineering education, high superconductivity, supercomputing and networking are issues that you find for the first time as cost cuts in the federal budget. In the past, you had to look in 18, 19 different places before you could pull the whole thing together. So I think that's a major kind of a change, and a very good one. All these things are necessary, but not sufficient. We are facing a formidable challenge as other nations become more competitive. And let me show some of that by the next one. I'll come back to this one if this is interesting. Probably one of the better charts. This essentially shows the non-defense spending of ourselves as a percent of GNP versus that of other countries. And you see essentially that we are far behind in that on that particular parameter. Similarly, if you look at the labor force per 10,000 employees, you see essentially where we had a massive lead in the 1960s, still had a lead in the 1970s. By 1986, some other countries have caught up with us and have been increasing their technical workforce in a significant kind of a way. By the way, there's good reason to focus on that, because if you look at the growth that in the professional employment, you see essentially that in the sciences and engineering, the biggest growth is occurring. It's bigger than in some of the other professional work areas, and certainly bigger than U.S. employment. So I think the demand is there. The question is, in the future, can we meet that particular demand? It's a paradox, by the way, that at the same time where this is happening, our students don't prefer these professions. And this essentially shows you that. They prefer business or some of the other areas, but not the sciences or engineering. And this is, by the way, over a 10-year kind of a time period, 5 years at a time, and things have not really improved. If anything, they've probably gotten worse. So that's one of the paradoxes that we have to worry about. So what should be the areas of concern be? I have three that I would like to suggest. The first one is technology policy. I want to move away from science policy for a minute to technology policy. The second one is a balance within the R&D budget. By the way, I always am being looked at with jaundiced eyes when I say it, but I'll say it again. I don't believe for a minute that we are not spending enough R&D funds in the United States. I think we do, but I don't think we're spending them properly. And I think that's why I want to focus on the balance within the R&D budget rather than just focusing on increasing R&D budgets. And the third area of concern is the cost of research. And can the universities really sustain the growth and sustain the level that they acquired because of some increases that are beyond their control, some of them that are beyond their control, and some of them are not. So let me talk about technology policy. The policy over the last decade has been that the federal government supports basic research, and the industry which is better equipped to do so essentially supports applied and development, or applied research and development. It's a good decision, but it didn't address the new issues that are being generated by a global competition in research and technology that I talked about before. The time from idea to market has been shortening in a significant kind of a way. Secondly, research in generic areas with major economic importance is becoming very costly. It's increasingly costly, certainly in semiconductors and supercomputing and superconductivity in many of the materials areas, in biotechnologies, you can name it. Not only costly, but also highly skill-based, and as a consequence, some of the skill shortages rear their head in these areas. Civilian research is becoming the principal source of innovation. If you ask yourself today in computer technology, in semiconductors in particular, where the new technologies are being first applied, it's no longer in the military arena, it's no longer even in supercomputing or in the supercomputer area where it was for a long time, it's in consumer products. Just see what goes into VCRs and displays that you can buy off the shelf anywhere. That's where the new technology is first applied. And that's a change. That's a major change. We didn't have that in the 50s and the 60s, where the military was the trailblazer of new technology. With peace breaking out all over the world, this is a major problem, obviously. DARPA has been the funder of last resort for this purpose, like HDTV and semiconductor. It's not clear that it can perform this role efficiently, or it's not even clear to me that it should perform this role. I think we would get a distorted kind of an output from it, and not because of DARPA, but because where they are located and where they get their instructions from and in what kind of an atmosphere they live. The recent trade bill tried to deal with part of this problem. Expanded functions of the old Bureau of Standards, now NIST, essentially were put in place, but the commitment and funding have been poor. Just look at the 1991 budget for NIST. It's nothing to write home about. There's a new position was created in the Department of Commerce, the Undersecretary of Technology, but that position is still not filled. And this is 18 months after it has been put into law. Certainly it's right now about 15 months within this new administration. still not felt. Therefore, one conclusion you can draw, it can be high on people's minds. So how we deal with this issue of technology development and technology policy and the related issues of improving the translation of ideas into products, I think is one of the issues that we need to be concerned about and deal with. The second issue I want to talk about is the balance in R&D. And this picture here really shows it to you in a nutshell. Our defense, or the part of the R&D budget that has been devoted to defense was as high essentially as 62%, 63%, 64%. It's dropping now, and especially in 91, it has been dropping significantly. But still, it's out of kilter to where it was at one time in the 70s, when it was more the 50-50 kind of a level. And by the way, in my opinion, that's about where it should be, around the 50-50 kind of a level. And that would free up a large number of dollars, by the way, significant amount of dollars, that you could fund all kinds of things with basic research, technology, and so forth. And that's why I made the comment before, that I don't believe that we have to increase necessarily our funding of R&D if we were willing to redistribute the funding. This means redistribution. And that's a difficult subject for a government and for Congress to do, as you know very well. The second thing that needs a rebalance is one that I don't think people are much aware of or give much thought to. Let me go back to the 1950s. You see, the overwhelming funder of research, basic research, at that time was DOD. Where did the funding go? Well, it went into the physical sciences, it went into mathematics, it went into engineering. Okay, those were essentially the beneficiaries. What has happened? Well, what has happened is that DOD has vanished from the chart, essentially, as a funding source of academic research and development. Who are the funders? Well, first of all, NIH. NIH is a big funder. After that, NSF. And there's quite a difference, by the way, between the two budgets, about 3-1 difference. But nevertheless, NSF is the next one in line. As a consequence of this one, if you look what happened to academic research, you essentially see that the physical sciences and engineering have stayed fairly well constant. And the life sciences essentially have taken over the majority of the funding. And I would suggest, not that I suggest that life sciences are not important, that's not my point, but I want to suggest that the balance between all of these various disciplines is out of whack. And it got out of whack because of the focus of DOD on development and applied research away from basic research. And we have not rectified, we have not recognized that for a long time, and when we started recognizing this, it essentially is a balance, to achieve the right balance is a long and drawn out kind of a process. A third concern that I want to talk about is a mounting strain on the university research enterprise, essentially. Economic constraints will persist well into the future. There's no doubt about that. But there are also things that are at work here. First of all, we are seeing a leveling off or even a decline in enrollments across the country in the sciences and engineering. And you see that that has been going on for some time. It was computer science which has really kept up the peak in a very artificial kind of a way. Artificial in as much as it was concentrated in that one area. It was not spread throughout. And now computer science is dropping off, and it becomes very apparent that that the production of undergraduate degrees in the sciences and engineering is on the decline in the country. So that's certainly one issue that universities are facing. The second one is the production of advanced degrees, especially PhD degrees. And you see, this is a ratio essentially of PhDs as a percent of BS degrees, time displaced by six years, I guess. You see the leveling off. You see how we came down and then the leveling off. The leveling off was primarily because of foreign students. It was not because of American students. Let me just show you. This essentially shows over since 1965 the increase in foreign PhD students in the various areas. It's not only engineering is always being cited as a big example, but it also happens in mathematics, and it happens to a lesser extent in some of the other physical sciences. So it's becoming more difficult to attract our own young people to careers in the sciences in engineering. At the same time, while that is happening, while the flattening off is occurring, the other thing that you have to recognize is, and you see it on the right-hand side, that the number of researchers in universities is on the increase. It's almost a straight line. Faculty has been leveling off, as I'm showing you on both sides. Enrollment has been leveling off, but the enterprise in total, especially the research part of it, is increasing at a rapid kind of rate. Why do I mention that? Well, I mention it because of the hue and cry that you hear in universities that we're not getting enough support. Can do our research. It's not the lack of support. As I showed you in the beginning, and as I probably want to, why don't you drag out this first, one of the first charts. As I showed you before, in fact, academic expenditures for basic research, applied research and development have been on the increasing. In the 1980s, they have been on the same, almost the same rate as in the good old days of the 1950s. With the hue and cry that you hear from faculty and from researchers and from students is we don't have enough support. And that's true too, by the way. Both of these statements unfortunately are true. Let me go back to the other one. Let me make the point. What is happening? Well, what's happening is that the enterprise is growing at a very fast rate. Go on to the next one. The other thing which is happening is the cost per researcher is increasing at a very rapid rate. Certainly and I'm talking here primarily obviously about the physical and life sciences and engineering. So we have essentially increasing support, increasing number of people, but also increasing costs, and the two multiply essentially, and they give you the deficit that we are experiencing, and that people talk about. So why don't I skip this too and go to this one. Now, why don't we wait for better times? It's one of the solutions. And I'm saying don't wait, because the better times are here and you don't like them. And, and therefore, let's move on, okay? Why do I say better times are here? Well, let me show you a few indices which we put together. What you see, it's the lower half, the three curves at the bottom of the chart, are essentially government, GNP indices, total GNP, and manufacturing GNP. And you see how that one has stayed fairly flat with a slight increase over the last few years. Then you look at the three top ones. That's federal academic R&D in the red line on the top, total academic R&D and university expenditures. And you see how those indices have moved at the same point in time. And there is a divergence. There's a divergence of what the country earns and what the country spends on academic research and related kind of subjects. And I'm saying the two are not going to diverge like that forever. They're going to close sometime, somewhere, in the near future. That's why I'm saying waiting for the future is not the answer to the university dilemma. There have to be some other answers. The answers have to come from within the system. And I realize saying that, that's easier said than done. So, that brings me pretty much to the end of my story. I don't think business as usual in the area of science and technology policy will not be good enough in the future. We can't afford that. The opportunity cost incurred by failure to rise to challenge of producing and using knowledge more effectively will be very high, and we have to address that. Certainly, of the three issues I discussed, the balance, the university enterprise, technology policy, I would say that all three are important, but probably one is more important than the other, namely the technology policy, which is in shambles today because we don't have one. We might not have a science policy either, by the way, but I think we have more of a science policy than of a technology policy. And with that, why don't I see what's on people's minds?
We're very pleased, Dr. Bloch, to have with us the provost of the university. I don't know quite how he does it because he says no to all of us most of the time, but he's still the most popular administrator at the university, so maybe he should ask
not
the first question.
Not in all circles.
Well, it's certainly a great pleasure to have you here, Dr. Bloch. I don't know, not sure where to begin. There are a number of things I would mention. Let me just mention one that concerns us a bit in the university areas, and that is connected with this drop-off in the number of students being interested in science. Because the danger is, there's a further danger in that a lot of the science that's carried on in the United States is carried on by the faculty members at various universities. However, more and more universities, particularly I think private as well as public, look and say, how do you justify this size faculty? Well, you justify it, of course, on the number of students. And so there's a further terrible danger to this drop-off in number of students that it could actually affect the number of university faculty members. And that's a frightening concern. I mean, for instance, at this university, we're worried about it, and we're starting to take steps to try to increase the number of students majoring in the sciences. Whether we'll succeed or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, but there again, the whole country is seeing that. And as a consequence, you're competing with each other for the students that are available, and that's becoming a diminishing pie also.
Well, the hope, of course, would be to stimulate more students to study science. Another way to address the faculty problem is to have all of our students taking more science, even if the number of science majors doesn't increase, so that we have a much more literate society in science.
Mathematics and science are neglected topics. So that's certainly one reason. The other one has to do with our culture, certainly, and with the value
system that the country is putting forth every night on television. No surprise.
Sir.
Could I ask either one of you, what about returning to the excitement that, for good or ill, was generated by this science education after Sputnik, when Zacharias and others came forward with new approaches to science? Should history repeat itself, or was that...
What do you want to shoot up? That's the issue, okay? That's one of the issues. By the way, again, you know, while that caused a lot of excitement, a lot of good ideas and so forth, it didn't last. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the trouble we are in today. 10 years afterwards, it was forgotten. And now we're starting up again. So it's really our persistence rate is not very good. And I think this is one of the concerns I have. You see some beginnings now of turning around pre-college education, and I'm afraid we are going 5 years from now, we'll say, okay, we'll solve the problem and walk away from it. And you know the problem is not solved. You have to have a consistent and persistent kind of a push on it. So my concern is that we will relax again.
Very worried.
Other questions?
May I offer a suggestion as to what to put up? And that might be the ecological problem that the world faces. And we talk a lot about it, but you see our government, we're stepping away from a strong position on global warming. And yet, I think the technological and scientific challenges of how to keep our population alive on our planet should be stimulating, and they apparently are not. But if somehow we could phrase that problem in the same or with the same degree of challenge that the Sputnik provided, then maybe we could attract more students into real science and technology, as opposed to worrying about the environment, but not being willing to take the courses and exert the effort to train themselves to be able to do something about it.
Well, you know, that has been suggested by a number of people. What's wrong with it? Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong with it, okay? I think it's a good idea. Unfortunately, it gets heavily involved in the politics of the situation, and you mentioned it yourself. And also in the uncertainty surrounding that issue. There's a debate, as you know, going on. How valid are all these models that people put up and the results from the models, and how to apply that to the real world, where you have political pressures and where you have economic pressures and where you have a third world pressure, which is completely different, on and on. And I'm afraid that that is not a unifying kind of a theme, like Sputnik was to this country. And it will drag on, number one, and the debate will be acrimonious. It's already, by the way, it'll get worse. And therefore, depending on that, is kind of a, you know, throwing an issue that is serious into the middle of a political issue, it might not be the right approach. Basically, I agree with you. I just seen.
I didn't mean to emphasize global warming totally. I think there are a number
global
of
environment. Yes, I know. It's global environment is a little bit more acceptable than global warming, but not much more.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to your last slide, and I'm not the economist, and maybe it's obvious to everyone.
I'm not either.
I guess I don't really quite understand the numbers. On the one hand, you told us that as a percentage of the gross national product remained fairly constant over time, and that we're...
No, it had an increasing, slope.
And in terms of European countries and other countries, we're falling behind. And then you show us various indices of the economy that have increased slightly. while the amount on research and development has increased threefold. Well, somehow there's something missing from the equation that I don't know what it is.
Well, there's something missing. First of all, it's not an equation. I was just trying to make a parallel kind of a conclusion. Namely, the conclusion is that, and you have seen it in other countries, and I'll give you an example. If the economy does not keep track with the needs of a country, then sooner or later, the universities will not keep track also with their own requirements. My main example is England, obviously. Look what has happened to English universities. You know, for a long time they stayed at the forefront of good basic research. Today they are falling behind. Why do they fall behind? Well, because of Margaret Thatcher. Well, Margaret Thatcher had nothing to do with it, obviously. She just happened to be around at the time when all these things came together. What had happened was essentially that the spending in by the government in universities outran its capabilities to do so. And that's the point I wanted to make. And I didn't want to draw an equation or saying one has to be 1.9 when the other one is 1.7 and can't be any higher. I just wanted to make that particular point that from a societal kind of a viewpoint, from a government kind of a viewpoint, these things don't run on their own. There is a tie back to the economic environment of the country. And that's the point I wanted to make.
Quite a few of you have indicated you have questions. We want to stay within the time limits, and Dr. Block has other commitments, but let's go ahead with as many questions as we can.
Comments. I have a brother of your Sputnik. I was in Cambridge at the time, and when they put up the two dogs, they had a 1 minute of silence for these two dogs. Person I was working with, he says, that's the British for you. We have 1.5 minute of silence for all of the men of all the wars that ever fought for England, and we have 1 minute of silence for two dogs. But my area of biomedical sciences, I think your projection of total budget is deceptive, because if you will look in the NIH budget, you see that AIDS and the genome project, this is, you see, but if you go to funding, last year NIH funded 29% of the approved grants. This year it's going down to around 20, so that
sure.
The main thrust of the biomedical research in this country is being greatly curtailed because of this discrepancy.
Well, look, I didn't say paradise was in the life sciences. Otherwise more people would be there. I didn't mean to imply that. I just wanted to say, look, we have had a major kind of a shift. Okay, that's all I tried to say. And I also made the point that I think the life sciences are as important as the physical sciences. But we step into these situations that cause dislocations. And we don't realize that we're causing these relocations. Then, and after a while, we wake up and say, look what has happened to us. And this happens to be one of these areas. The total funding for basic research in all of the areas, life sciences and physical sciences and engineering, is not enough. I think the R&D funding is sufficient, but we are not funding basic research in all areas. I'm the first one to admit this. I just wanted to show that there had been a dislocation occurring that we didn't realize what's going on. That was the only point I wanted to make. Yeah, I know NIH drop-off to 20% is not very good. By the way, the National Science Foundation dropped from 39% success rates in 1980, 1981, to about 30% today. So you see a similar kind of a phenomenon. And we are going to top first. No doubt about it. Yes.
It strikes me that the legislative branch is not the best place in the world to be deciding what is appropriate expenditures on various types of scientific. Legislators tend to make their decisions based on the criteria of having relatively little to do with the content of the science.
Yes.
NSF's programs are very diversified, obviously, from individual research grants to large programs and technology centers. Do you see a change in the future? Is there a better, is there a different strategy that's going to be employed in terms of handling American science?
You mean different strategy and the balance?
Balances.
The balance within? Well, one of the strategies which you should have seen coming into play in a significant kind of a way is our focus on education and human resources. And that certainly happened over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And that's eating out of the total, obviously. We presented some of these numbers to Congress. We were about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, mid-70s, education and human resources were about 3% of our budget. Today it's 20%. So that significantly leads into, so that's one shift. And education and human resources means many things. It means graduate fellowships, it means pre-college education, it means programs for minority and women, it means EBSCO, which is a program for under participating states in research and education. So it means a lot of things. That's certainly one shift. The other shift is towards multidisciplinary research, which is what you alluded to when you said science and technology centers. And that's certainly a shift. The other shift, which obviously occurs all the time, in the last few years, we have been focusing very heavily on Bill's area, computer science and engineering, as well as in engineering in general, on materials, like biotechnology. Despite NIH, we are the major supporter for, one of the major supporters of biotechnology.
Dennis Barnes?
Dr. Blackwell. Very interested when you showed the slide showing the cost per investigator going up, and I look at what we'll face with faculties with the limited pool we're all going to be competing for. How is the federal government going to modulate or avoid simply underwriting a bidding war among us for that limited pool?
Well, I don't know if we're going to avoid it. I don't know. I tell you, I really don't know. Why should the government do anything?
That's what I mean. But how will you avoid it?
Well,
why would we
avoid? I mean, why do you want the government in the middle of this? How about you people avoiding it among yourselves?
But it's very hard for any individual school to do that. You do get out of it a bit with.
Gee, you got associations. You got a DuPont, number one DuPont circle full of associations. Mm-hmm. What are they doing? Yeah, I don't know, but maybe you do. But that would be certainly one thing that they could do.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe your provost is a better source to answer that question.
I mean, basically the universities compete for the various scientists with their resources,
right,
with their internal resources. Now, it may well, part of the equation may well be that if Stanford is hiring a physicist, that they are, when at the time of hiring, they are discussing, well, let's see, he's going to cost us $1 million in setup funds of our money. But they say, but through overhead, we will regain because he will get good grants. That kind of discussion goes on. but that's certainly not bringing the National Science Foundation or the federal agencies into the competing, into the bidding war, because that person would, is going to be funded at that given level by NSF regardless of where he is.
Right.
Well, in a sense, when you put the salary cap on, that is the level of salary that the foundation would reimburse, or NIH has done the same thing, I don't know whether that was conscious, but that would tend to have a limiting effect.
Well, look, first of all, we didn't put it on.
Right.
Okay, Congress did. So that's point number one. And point number two, that the motivation for that was completely different. That was Mr. Proxmire, who felt that a university professor isn't worth more than a senator. Okay? Very simple. It's about as simple as that.
It's interesting that he's going to McCaffrey Maine.
Well, because his successor is thinking in
that's
same
right.
terms. It wasn't just Mr. Proxmire.
Warren Henry, do you have any public administration issues you want to raise on this OMB or otherwise? Graham, other people?
No.
One last thing, Ken, if I could make one comment to Dr. Block. And it's a very self-serving comment from the point of view of universities.
You're entitled to it.
But it may be true, and that is that as we look, and I've thought back over my many years at the university, and I've thought at times how wonderful it is, what the tremendous thing that the NSF has done for this country. Maybe it's not even true, but I think it is. I think that the NSF has helped this country in incredible ways, and that has maintained the science in this country at a time when it probably would have folded or really deteriorated without the presence of the NSF. But one thing that's very interesting is that if you look at the universities, you look at one area is material science and solid-state physics. You look at it and you see how the NSF is supporting grant after grant after grant. It is keeping these research groups alive. These research groups are training the young PhDs in the country. And the young PhDs are going off and being hired by IBM and Bell and various industries, and who presumably benefit pretty quickly by the talent that these people have, and also by the education they've received. Yet, from our point of view, they're making almost no contribution. The industrial contribution is very low, and that maybe you could correct me toward that training. I need to be corrected.
Yeah, you need to be corrected. Look, first of all, that's not true, because industry pays taxes.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And they support.
And you
NSF.
Live off, and
yes, sir.
And we live off taxes. I mean, NSF
right.
gets tax dollars.
Right.
It's your dollars coming back to you. Mm-hmm. Or IBM's dollars going back to IBM via one of your graduates, or to AT&T or wherever. So that's number one. Number two, I have been impressed, by the way, and maybe I'm the only one, by the fact that over the last 8-9 years, industry is funding quite a bit of basic research in universities. Now I agree. It's only 7% of all academic R&D, but it was only 3%, was half of that a few years ago. Now I must also say that they are highly selective what they are funding, certain disciplines, certain institutions. Okay, it's not uniformly spread throughout all institutions, but I know one where industry research is about 35% of their total research. Fairly significant. In fact, I know two. I might even know three, I don't know, but certainly know two. So I would say industry is doing quite a bit. It's certainly paying taxes. I'll tell you, where I have a problem, and I know this is not one of the universities I should make that speech to, but you get it anyway, because I need to make that speech, and secondly, you might fall into the same bad habits, okay? I think what I have a problem with is foreign companies coming in here and taking advantage of university research and paying what I call incremental costs. $1 million, because that dean or that provost needs $1 million or a building of 5 or 10 million, because that institution, that university needs a building, and why not get it from Toyota? Because you can't get it out of the National Science Foundation, and I think that's a giveaway. I have no problem, by the way, with foreign companies coming to universities and wanting to participate and taking part of the research results, but go, they should pay the full cost and not incremental cost.
Well, we've gone a little beyond what we had pledged to Mr. Wolf we would try to stick to in our scheduling, so, but I think it's been well worthwhile. Somebody said, if you can get Eric Block, he'll tell it like it is. And I think we've had a good example of that this morning, and we're most grateful to you.
Thank you for the invitation.